No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation and call in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. And here we are coming to you in the midst of a political brawl in New Hampshire. Maria, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Michael. This week has been monumental in the way that we do business in the United States of America. And you had a front row seat to it in Iowa. Excuse me. I swallowed wrong. Do you swallow often? Oh, no, just intermittently.
Yeah.
You know, I always brew a cup of tea before we begin our program. Excuse me. But, Michael, I want to know what you saw and what you learned with the debacle that we know as the Iowa caucus that may be our last. But can we give our listeners a little history of how it is that Iowa does what it does and why it is first in the nation with selecting representatives?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and I'm not sure that I can tell you the situation that exists now. I'm not really sure, Maria, and maybe I should have done my homework on how this all came about that Iowa's first, although I know that Iowa has had to fight a battle on several occasions to stay first. And, you know, the state party is the one that sets up the primary process, chooses to do a caucus or a regular, you know, what we all think of in the rest of the states as a primary where you go to the polls and you vote. But then the DNC has to approve it. So I'm not sure what the history of the interaction between the two of them has been, but today they're hanging on by a thread. And because people at the DNC are upset about it, obviously, Tom Perez, who's chairman of the DNC, is calling for a recount.
Yeah, and they call it something else, though, which is interesting.
Right, they do call it something else, a recanvass.
Yes.
And the reason they call it a recanvass is because it's actually going back over the whole process. It's not just counting up the votes, because the process itself is very, very complicated. And so they have to go back and look at the process as well as the number of votes. And, you know, when you think about it, all the money and time and effort that's going into this, we're talking about 41 delegates. There's 41 delegates.
At stake. Right. And they also say that Iowa doesn't represent the demographics of our country. And you have to be registered to vote to go to this per precinct caucus to the party of which you're registered. And these caucuses also select delegates to county conventions and party committees. So it's not just about the presidency.
That's true. And that's probably true of other primaries, too. But, yes, this is just the first stage, because they also, and we'll talk about this in a minute, the reason that we were there, they also take on issues. And those issues, once they're established, I'll tell you the resolution we put forth. Once it's approved at our caucus and maybe several caucuses around the state, then it would have to move up to the county convention. It would have to be approved there and then go on and be approved at the state. So it's a somewhat complicated process. And you're right, it doesn't deal with just the not only doesn't it deal just with the president, it doesn't deal with just the candidates. It deals with issues as well. And it's the first step in a three-step process. So
and here's the other thing, the question that I have for you before we go into what it was that you saw this time, because you've been more than once, obviously. We've covered it since I've been your co-host on the program. But it is also for Democrats and Republicans. And yes. The only snafu was with the Democrat system. So I'm curious, how come there weren't repercussions similarly within the Republican caucuses?
Well, because the Republicans only have one candidate this time. And there have been... There have been snafus with the Republicans as well in the past. And that's one thing they point to, that it's, there are some people that stand out there and point to the fact that it's the process and not the party so much, because they've had problems. They had problems with Mitt Romney, I remember, and I forget, last time, Ted Cruz won. The last time I was in Iowa in 2016, Ted Cruz won, beat Donald Trump. Then there was some question about delegates with Mitt Romney. So that's what some people that want to replace the process have to say. They say it's not so much a flaw in the way the Democrats conducted; it's just a flaw in the whole
system.
In the system itself,
right.
And it's a shame. And you can see when you're there. Look. The people of Iowa are the nicest people on the planet, and they line up. It's the most amazing process you've ever seen. You're in a gymnasium, for example. That's where we were. We're in a gymnasium. Now there's only a handful of people in the Republican caucus, which is across the hall. But that's another thing. The Republicans and the Democrats are in the same building. They're shaking hands and hugging each other because they're neighbors, right? I mean, it's a beautiful process. But then you get into the gym and you've got your Warren delegates and your Buttigieg delegates and your Sanders delegates and your Biden delegates. And they sit in the bleachers and they actually count them. That's the first ballot. They just count heads. They don't fill anything out. They just go through and they count the heads.
Couldn't that mean that somebody could bring anybody that wasn't a resident of the state of Iowa?
I could have sat down. Now, if I had sat down, probably if I sat down with the Warner people, probably the precinct captain, who knows, because it's such a localized process, might say to me, hey, who are you?
Right.
But if they didn't, they could have counted me, sure.
Right.
And you go in, like every other caucus, every other type of voting, when you go in, you go to somebody who's sitting at a table with the voter rolls, and you say, my name is Maria Sanchez, and they look you up and they go, okay, Maria, you're registered as a Democrat. You live, at 120.
In this neighborhood, right?
Right. So you're in this precinct. You're good to go. But they don't give you a card or a little sign to hang around your neck or anything. You just walk into the gymnasium. So it's a really, really beautiful but arcane process. So you can understand why people want to replace it. I really hope they don't. Because it really is an amazing process.
Let's just say this. It would be nice, perhaps, based on your personal experience, not mine, if you think it's a beautiful process, but not have it be the kickoff to the season of who it is that's going to be on the ballot. In other words, do it midway through. Say, do it in April or May. Or like California once was in June, And so there won't be all those resources, the time, the energy, and the focus spent on Iowa, because it's really unscientific.
Well, look, this the part of this process that's the problem is the press. Look, I know you're a sports fan, so let's put this in a sports analogy. Okay. There are 41 delegates out of 3,000 out of 4,000 delegates, 3,979. And listen to the, you know, if you're listening to MSNBC or CNN or Fox, you know, people are talking about how Biden's in trouble and Warren's in fourth place. This is like saying you're in the Super Bowl and it's 2 minutes gone in the first quarter and the other team scored a field goal and you're saying, oh, this is horrible. Mm-hmm. Kansas City is out of it now. They've scored a, you know what I mean? I mean, this is one, there are 57 primaries and this is the first one. So
part which of is why is I press. Suggest let's stop giving it so much prominence.
Well, you know, poor little Iowa though, right?
Who's, well, there's what, a lot of candidates ever going to go.
Yeah, what candidates ever going to go back there
well,
again?
And California is somewhat similar, which is interesting because we're so blue. A lot of candidates don't even bother because they just assume that right. they're going to. Especially Republicans don't bother because what's the point? So Iowa, with their little paltry population, they're lucky to get all of this press publicity. Look at you. You were there. Could you go through for our listeners what it is that you did, how, when, and why? Like, yeah, you got there when?
Yeah, and before and we how? Start, well, before we start that, we have a monumental thing happening on Statehood this week. So okay. that I don't forget, Tuesday at 10 a.m. in the Rayburn Building, if our listeners are local and they want to come, we're going to do a markup of the Statehood Bill. The Statehood Bill will be marked up. They're saying it could take as much as 12 hours, spread out over 2 days. We expect lots of amendments from people who oppose us. But if it once it's marked up, it'll go to the floor. Steny Hoyer said he thinks it'll go to the floor sometime over the summer, and it will pass. And we'll, for the first time, have a statehood bill that's passed the House of Representatives, and we'll move on to the Senate, where unfortunately it will probably come to a screeching. I think we'll come to a screeching halt. So I just want to mention that there's several overflow rooms. If you're interested and you want to support DC statehood, come to the Rayburn Building, Rayburn House Office Building at 10 a.m. and we'll be there.
Will you stream it? Can you stream it?
No, I don't think so. Oh. I don't know. It will be on C-SPAN, I'm sure.
Okay.
But we're not allowed to even speak. There are no witnesses. Where I get to sit in the room where it's all going on with a handful of other people, probably about 50 people in the room. I get to sit there, but nobody gets to testify. Nobody gets to talk except the members of Congress who will work out, you know. Basically, what they're doing is they're editing the bill to make it ready to go to the floor.
So, and who is they?
The members of the House Oversight Committee, where the bill rests now. So people know the process, I guess, pretty. You know, a bill is proposed, it's put in committee, it's reported out of committee, and it goes to a vote. So right now it's in committee, it's in the House Oversight, Government Affairs, or Government Reform and Oversight Committee. Eleanor Holmes Norton is one of the people on that committee, although she doesn't have a floor vote. She has a committee vote, but some of Trump's strongest allies, like Mark Meadows, are also on the committee. And of course, because of the partisan nature of our city, they don't like the bill. So it's going to be a little bit of a battle. But we're sure in the end, because we have the votes in the committee, it'll be reported out and it will go for a floor vote. And it's a big day for us, even though it's not the end of the journey. It's certainly a milestone, and we try to hold on to what Dr. King said to us, you know, that if you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl, but keep moving forward. So this is a move forward. It's not the end-all, be-all, but it's a move forward. Now, on to Iowa to answer your question.
Well, and it's a part of the process. And so congratulations. You're getting to the next level. Wonderful. Yeah.
And thank you for that. And so we go to Iowa to put these two reasons. We put these resolutions in, and we want to get attention. So luckily for us, there's an amazing group called Iowans for D.C. Statehood. One of the people that's involved in this group is the former Democratic Party leader, chairman of Polk County, which is the county where Des Moines is. It's one of the biggest voting areas. So she knows everybody. Everybody. All you have to do is drop her name. Every candidate's met her. Every candidate, even though she's not doing it anymore, I'm sure she's glad, right, on this particular go around, that she's not responsible for counting up the votes. But they were just amazing. We had a press conference out there with the group, and I was lucky enough to get these people as our escort. This is Tamara and Paul Harrison, and so before we go any further, let me give shout out to the Harrisons. They're amazing people. They were so gracious to take us all around. And what we did was...
What day are you speaking of?
Now, we show up on Saturday.
The first.
Okay. We immediately go to a Warren event. I'm with my daughter, who has sworn that she will never do anything political in her entire life, because she hates it. And
you have two daughters, so which
one? I have two daughters. Oh, my God. We have to pause in the show.
The first or the second. You can do that.
Well, first I've got to say, because Mrs. Brown will just take me and beat me when I get off the radio if I don't mention this. Today is Mary Brown's birthday.
Okay.
She's the younger one. She's 22 years old.
Okay.
Today. God bless you, Mary.
Happy birthday, Mary.
And so I took Tricia, the older one, with me, who
lives in Chicago, right?
Lives in Chicago, swore she would never get involved. And today I tried to reach her, and she was out knocking on doors for Elizabeth Warren. So, you got to take your kids and expose them to stuff, because if you leave them to their own devices, they will spend their lives in cyberspace somewhere.
Navel gazing.
Yeah. So we go out there. First thing we do, we go to a Warren event. They put us up on stage. This is the picture we used in our promo this week.
Michael, have you endorsed a candidate?
No, I have not.
Okay.
And it seems that Tricia is gaga, as many young women were, for Elizabeth Warren. And I got to tell you, after going to two rallies, I got to talk to Senator Warren for a couple of seconds. I'd say a minute, but it probably wasn't that long. And I got to also talk to Vice President Biden. We went to a Yang event and a Buttigieg event.
Wow.
But Elizabeth Warren is an amazing speaker. She's inspirational. It's like listening to John Kennedy give a speech. And before, you know, we'll get into this maybe if we have time a little later about the candidates, but I got to tell you, she's the best campaigner, in my opinion. She's just amazing. You know, what she did, Maria, when we came to the rally, the first thing she did was she had her staff go out and take all little girls out of the audience and bring them backstage. Now, she doesn't put them up on stage, because that would look exploitive.
Right. But
every one of those little girls comes out, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, with a even younger sometimes, with a grin from ear to ear. So you understand that they've had a personal interaction with the candidate. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, she speaks. She has so much energy, and she speaks like you look at her and you say, I know this woman. That's the most powerful thing I think you can say in politics, is to make that connection. And you know this woman. This woman was your third grade teacher. This woman was the lady that taught you in Sunday school. This woman was the woman that lived across the street that bought chocolate chip cookies, you know, at the holidays, bought holiday cookies to your house. You know, she really connects with people. And then we went to her rally afterwards. She has her two grandchildren introduce her. Her grandchildren are like, I would guess, like 7 and 9. There's a little boy that says, you know, my grandmother Elizabeth is, I want to introduce her. We call her Gamma. We call her Gammy. We call her Gammy. Every woman in the audience goes, oh my God, she calls her Gammy. You know, right? And then the little girl says, and she's running for president because that's what girls do. And oh my God, the audience erupts. Every young woman starts cheering, that's what girls do. That's what girls do. You know, so she's keyed into, right, a lot of what's going on. Joe Biden says, who's a candidate that I very much like, says all the right things, but he doesn't generate that kind of excitement that, in my humble opinion, that Elizabeth generates, that Senator Warren generates. So that was the first thing we did. We went to that. Then we had a press conference. We held a press conference.
D.C. for statehood.
I went for D.C. statehood.
Okay.
At a press conference. And that was just great. You know, it was live streamed and we had a bunch of people there and it was really good. And then in the middle of all this, we're going to different events. We went to a Buddha gig event, which was just packed with young people, tons of young people. And this is the greatest thing that we encountered in going through this process. And in a minute, I'm going to connect it all to the process. But there were a ton of young people at Buddha gig. I was interviewed by a high school class. Now, like for a half an hour, you know, they were just so enthralled to be there. And there was a line as far as the eye could see. And the same thing at the Yang event. I mean, you know,
Yang, who didn't even get on the radar, he got 1% or something.
Didn't even get on the radar, but they're bringing young people into the process. And you know, when I was at the DNC, I mean, Tom Perez is going to hate that I say this, but we didn't even deal with young people. They didn't vote. They didn't give us money, mm-hmm. you know. So we dealt with people over 50 years mm-hmm. old because they were the people who went to the polls.
What do we call those, the Gray Panthers?
Yeah, the Gray Panthers. And the attentive, you know, political scientists call them the attentive public, people that pay attention, or super voters that vote in primaries. And at this point, especially in the primary process, we didn't pay any attention to them.
So it's so funny that I've always voted in the primary since I was 18.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't realize that was an age thing.
Mm. It certainly isn't. I don't know if that's the same. You know, I can't comment on the Republican primaries, but certainly in the Democratic primaries. And it was really Howard Dean that started bringing people, young people in. He raised more money than any other candidate had ever raised over the internet. And it was from young people. And they started to creep into the process more by giving money and by being politically active. They've always been troops on the ground, you know. Not that 50 plus people don't go and knock on doors, but they've often been fodder for campaigns where they come and they knock and they really do the legwork and they pass out literature. And, you know, they've always been part of that process, but voting, no. You know, and I remember when we were going to get Richard Nixon out because, you know, young people, when I was in college, we didn't like President Nixon. It was the middle of the Vietnam War, and we all went out and voted for McGovern, and I was ready to party the morning after the election, and I opened the paper and realized that it was me and like three other people that voted for McGovern. Right? I mean, he lost. We were stunned that we didn't do that, you know.
Well, that shows confirmation bias that you only traveled with people who thought the same way you did.
Right, and that's a problem. You know, when I had the former co-host of this show, Kathleen Gomez, told me that Trump was going to win, and I said, no way. And she said to me, you're in a bubble in Washington, D.C. Uh-huh. You don't get it. If you lived in the middle of Kansas, where she was living at the time, she said, you would understand what was going on. And I'm like, no way, no way, no way. And obviously she was right. We do live in a bubble here, and we do hang with people that are just like us. And it's really hard because of that to make political predictions, I think. But that's part of the beauty of the process in Iowa, is that it brings all sorts of people together. And you have to sit there and interact with them. It's not just your friends. It's not just the people that are from the same walk of life that you are. And we often lecture young people, you know, when you don't vote, you not only do yourself a disservice, you do every young person that's like you a disservice, because that's what politicians look at. So,
well, and your opinion doesn't matter because you don't bother to go to the polls.
Right, and nobody else's opinion that your age matters.
Right.
When young people don't vote, you know, there's a reason that we don't cut Social Security and we do cut education.
Yes.
You know? Because old people vote and young people don't. And when young people start voting, which I hope they will this time, in bigger numbers, then we'll care more about the policies that affect young people than we will about the policies that affect old people.
Which is interesting that Bernie attracts the younger audience.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing that's disturbing about this younger audience with Bernie is the vitriolic attacks on the internet from anybody that has anything to say about Bernie Sanders. You just get attacked. Your personal life is exposed. I mean, they've just been ruthless. And I don't get it, because I got to be honest with you, I'm not sure that I support Senator Sanders, but I'll tell you that he's one of the nicest guys I've ever met. He's an honest politician. I can't believe that he would ever do anything like this, you know, or support anything like this. But he's got all these trolls that are out there. And I don't know if you've been reading about it in the news this week.
I have not.
But yeah, there's terrible things where they said to somebody that had an autistic child, you're an idiot, just like your kid. Or they said to someone who had stage 4 cancer, too bad you didn't die.
Oh,
you know,
dear.
I mean, it's just horrible, horrible things. And you know, as a politician on the internet, I think we have to call that out and say it's wrong. And you know, it's wrong on every level. And it just shows how divided our country is. But, you know, that's the beauty of the caucus process, is that people have to sit down and listen to each other. Now, one thing that happened that was very disturbing for me was that we were at a caucus where, first let me explain how the caucus process works.
Perfect.
You have to reach a threshold of 15% to be considered viable.
And who's polling that?
Well, they're doing it right there in the room. So, you know, there's 100 people there, and under the Maria Sanchez banner, there's 14 people. So Maria doesn't qualify unless she can get...
Oh, so it's a body count. It's
yes.
It's not some Harris poll or AP
no.
poll or something.
No, it's for your particular caucus. And this is the funny thing, right? That at my caucus panned out pretty much like the rest of the caucuses. I think it was...
When you say mine, you mean the one that you visited?
The one that I attended.
Okay.
Yeah, there are over 1,000 of these across the state. So I came to one And on the first ballot, Warren did not qualify. So she gets no delegates. But there's a second ballot, and she can convince people to come over to her. And that was the funniest thing, is that you needed, you know, it's very lighthearted on a lot of levels. You needed, in my caucus, 15%, the threshold. That's the first thing they do is they count everybody, and they figure out what 15% is, and it was 47. You had to have 47 votes, and Warren had 45. So she went over to the gang people who had like 12 and tried to convince some of them to come over. You know, they try to convince you, hey, look, your candidate's not going to qualify, but Warren's a good candidate, come on over. And the gang people, they stood up on the chair and they said, no, we're not sending two people over there. You need to send 35 people over here.
Oh, boy. You know?
And everybody laughed. I mean, it wasn't serious. Nobody, 35 delegates were not going to go over to
right. The
gang to make, you know. So, and they ultimately got two delegates from the Klobuchar people, you know, who I guess, you know, and that's the way they appeal, right? They say.
Now, why didn't the Yang people go somewhere else knowing that their Yang vote wasn't going to count for anything?
I don't know. Some of them probably did. But it didn't much matter in the end. And so I'm sure the pitch to the Klobuchar people was, look, you've got two women candidates here, and one of them can make it. One of them can make, you know, the threshold. So, you know, you want Amy, and that's great. In fact, Amy Klobuchar had some powerful people in the precinct, you know, some of the top people that happened to live in that precinct pulling for her, and they ended up going to Warren. They you know, I guess their attitude was they wanted to get a woman candidate, they wanted to support a woman candidate, and their candidate wasn't going to win, so they went over to Warren. And this is another beautiful part of the process, is that it requires you to compromise. It requires you to say, you know, and, you know, that's a problem in for the Democrats. We have an old saying in politics that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. Right? And so Democrats very often, I was at the convention last time, and for 2 days, the Bernie delegates from California was sitting next to us, they were screaming at the stage, Bernie, Bernie, Bernie. And finally, Sarah Silverman came out to give a speech, and she turned and looked at the people and said, shut the F up, it's over, you know. But they, you know what I mean? They're just as willing sometimes, candidates are just as willing to shoot the other candidate, shoot themselves in the foot, by not supporting their party's candidate because of their love for whatever candidate they supported. So that's another beautiful thing about the caucus process, is it makes you sit down and think, you want your candidate to win, but if he can't win or she can't win, you need to support a candidate that can win. So that's another beautiful thing of the part of the process. But in the end, two things that amazed me. They finished in the order, I believe, of Sanders.
Well, are you showing that you're talking about the latest results?
No, I'm talking about my particular caucus.
Oh, okay.
So it was Sanders, Buttigieg, Warren, and Biden. Biden and Warren. But they each got two votes out of the caucus. They all tied, basically, even though one finished at the top of the thing and one finished in fourth place. There were eight delegates in our particular precinct, in our particular caucus, up for grabs, and they all got two delegates. So in the end, that's a little strange too, right? There's not a winner-take-all. They split. Then they talk about issues. They discuss issues and they vote on issues, and we put in a resolution. I didn't get to speak to it. Last time I got to speak to it, I got to give, you know, a presentation at the beginning, and our resolution passed unanimously. This time, since we didn't get a chance to speak, we handed out resolutions, and you had to sign the resolution and turn it in. So I think we did. We got there early, and we talked to people on a one-to-one basis. So the first thing that amazed me was that everybody walked away with the same amount of delegates. The second thing, which I found very troubling, is that somebody walked up to me and said, this precinct is 60% black, and there was maybe 10% of the people there were black. So black people didn't come to the caucus. Oh, no, for the Democrats. Yeah, oh, no, because they're an important segment.
Of course.
Right. And so that's one thing the Democrats really have to look at is why they weren't showing up for the caucuses. And you know, my knee-jerk reaction to this is because both viable black candidates in the Democratic Party no longer exist.
Right.
Kamala Harris and you know, Cory Booker are no longer in the process. And so I don't know if African Americans think they don't have somebody to vote for, but they're not there.
I thought they were huge Joe Biden fans.
Well, they are huge Joe Biden fans, but, you know, the problem we had last time was they didn't come out to vote in the numbers that they were expected to vote, you know. So you can say, yeah, among all these people, I like Joe Biden, but that's not enough to get me to the polls. That's going to be a real problem for the Democrats, you know. It was unlike the women's vote last time where Democrats were surprised that Trump was able to split that vote for them. The African-American vote was a little different in that they just didn't show up. And that was one problem that's come from, come out of the process. And, you know, again, going back to what we were talking about earlier about people that are against the caucuses, you'll see right now from the latest polling in New Hampshire that Mayor Pete's in number one spot, Bernie's in the second spot, you know, and they came to a virtual tie, and then you've got Biden and Warren. So
that's how Iowa has unfolded.
Right, and that's what people are saying about the process, too.
So here's my question to you, though, Michael.
Yeah.
What do you think about Bloomberg when he's finally able to enter into the discussion?
Well, at this point, I think he looks particularly smart, you know, that he didn't get involved in the maelstrom that's ended up being the Iowa caucuses, and that he stayed out of it, and he's waiting until Super Tuesday. You know, a third of all the delegates are decided on Super Tuesday. So you come out of Super Tuesday smelling like a rose, and you are on a roll. So
because he's definitely got my attention.
Well, and you know what? He doesn't. You know, Super Tuesday is in the very beginning of March, and as of the end of February, there's only a handful of delegates. You know, you only have this, you have New Hampshire, you have Iowa, New Hampshire, and you have South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And you know, but beyond that, then it's Super Tuesday. So he's really not losing very much at the
beginning. And you know, what's been interesting is that people are like, yeah, but he's not you know, he can't participate in the debates, although the DNC has changed that now, too, with the qualification requirements. And I'm like, nobody's watching the debates.
Yeah.
People are hearing and seeing his ads, however.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, how much he's spending on that. But in general, people aren't tuning in to the debates. So where I was thinking that he was in a deficit because of the late entry and the not getting people to donate to him, I think in the end, it's probably going to work to his advantage because he's super focusing on the consumers, on the demographics that matter.
And you know what? You're right. Nobody's listening to the debates except the people in New Hampshire and people like me who have already made up their mind that they're either going to vote as a Democrat or a Republican, you know.
Now, when is your, when is the District of Columbia?
It's in June. It's at the very end.
Oh, like and we used to be. Because we're now March 3rd, California. Yeah. We actually matter a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. June, and there was an argument in the Democratic Party at the beginning, at the local level, to move it up to be in the very beginning, so that we would have more impact. But you know what? It, in my opinion, that was that would have been wrong, because we're not California. Mm-hmm. You know, we have 20 pledged delegates. And let me explain to people that there's a difference. There is a total of 4,750 delegates. So you need about 2,400 delegates to win. But there are 771 superdelegates. So they're unpledged, which means they can vote for anybody at the end. And they end up being a real wild card in the process. And that's where their power comes in. But when we talk about 41 delegates from Iowa, we're talking about pledged delegates, people that are pledged to a particular candidate. Well, D.C. only has 20 delegates. Now, if it gets to be really, really close at the end, 20 delegates could make a difference. And we have 44 delegates, including superdelegates, because we get a lot of superdelegates. D.C. gets more superdelegates than percentage-wise than any other jurisdiction, because everybody, superdelegates are either elected officials or they're what's called important party people, you know.
And so, you're a superdelegate.
Yeah, because by virtue of my office that I'm elected. But, you know.
So wait, let's just give our listeners a perspective on that, because what you just said about what the District of Columbia has, the state of California has almost 500 delegates.
Right.
415 are pledged delegates. So we're a huge player in the outcome.
A huge player. And you know what? A huge player going early in the caucus, in the primary process, can push a candidate forward and can give them momentum. 20 delegates, or even 44 if you include the superdelegates, is not going to do that. So you're taking a big chance by being at the end, but being at the end, you might have some impact, you know?
You might tip the balance.
Yeah, if it's really close at the end, then maybe. But in the beginning, nobody's going to care about your 20.
And interestingly, Sanders has invested more in the state of California at this moment than anybody else. And just today was in the news that he's putting offices in Hispanic, Latinx communities, and the folks who are either on staff or volunteers are bilingual, and they're knocking on doors that haven't been knocked on ever before.
Well, first of all, you know that America believes that you guys are socialists to begin with. You're the socialist. California is a socialist state. So he feels a kindred spirit and feels, as you've already pointed out, 500 delegates is an awful, awful tempting, right? You really want to do that. Yeah. And he's smart to do that. He's smart to put bilingual people in there. He himself, I believe, is bilingual. I've heard him speak Spanish in the past. I don't know about the other candidates. I wouldn't be surprised if several of them are bilingual. But he's smart to do that, because there are no Latino.
Bloomberg has physically been to California more than anybody else.
Yeah.
Fresno, Sacramento, Los Angeles, San Diego. He's, you know, his feet have literally been in the state. So it's funny, because you can say, well, somebody who's investing a lot of money in the state must really care about the state. And then I would suggest that somebody who's actually putting their time in the state might actually suggest that they're more invested in the state, because they're literally spending the daylight and whatever, because Bloomberg is obviously not raising funds, right? I've heard that he's been courting wealthy donors and he's telling them to contribute to the DNC.
Yeah, well, that, you know, this guy, like I said to you earlier about Warren being a great campaigner, he's being a great strategist. Because once the candidate gets the nomination, they can no longer raise money. A lot of people don't know this, but once a candidate's nominated, he can no longer raise any money at all.
Oh, interesting. So you're saying the RNC and the DNC fund the campaign.
Right, because he's
the candidate. Oh, isn't that revealing?
Yeah.
Because I was thinking how selfless that was.
Well, you know, it does appear selfless because whoever, and I wouldn't say that it's not on some level selfless, because whoever the candidate is going to get that bounty. But if you're a smart strategist, you say, if I don't get the nomination, it's not going to matter to me anyway, right?
Right.
So I get to do this thing that's selfless on the surface, and then if I make it, then I reap the benefit of that. Mm-hmm. And if somebody else makes it and reaps the benefit of it, why do I care? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to be a spoiler. And certainly it may not only seem selfless to people out there, it's certainly going to seem selfless to the DNC.
Well, it did feel that way to me. And in the end, you're right, it is selfless. But in the end, it may be to his benefit if he becomes the nominee. What do you think are the odds? I mean, you personally.
I don't know. I think that we're in a terrible situation right now with these guys attacking each other. You know, they're all standing up on the stage saying, look, no matter, we need to beat Donald Trump. And that's a party thing to say. Right. And we're all going to come together. But are we all going to come together? They're up there, you know, pointing out everybody's flaws, right? It's true that Buttigieg was the mayor of a city of 100,000 people. You know, most people in America live in bigger cities than that. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Klobuchar attacked him and said, mm-hmm. you know, that, right, that he wasn't interested, right?
Yeah. She quoted one of his tweets.
Right.
Actually verbatim.
Because right.
I read what she said, and then I read what he tweeted, and she was spot on.
Right.
But, you know, that was then and this is now. I always think about our history. Sometimes we're not as wise as we become, and I don't think necessarily that short-sighted statements should be held against you. Because maybe you've evolved, or maybe you've gotten wiser, or maybe you've learned more. But yeah, she pulled that out at the debate, and I was like, "Ooh, I have to tell you, Michael. I've been in campaigns, most of them local, as a manager. And one of our races locally for assembly, the woman who was running against the incumbent was known for being really pointed with her dirt throwing, and so he asked me to be a debate partner for him, pretending to be her." And they gave me exact quotes of things that she had said. And I felt filthy even saying her words to him. And yet, guess who won? She did.
Yeah.
And you appear to stay above that fray in your elections.
Well, you know what? I that's a benefit that I have. You know, I would like to... I would like to say that I'm just this wonderful guy that gets to you know speak my mind. But the truth of the matter is, you know, that I'm in an office which allows that, where people are not of, you know, they see me as an advocate. They don't see me as an adversary. I'll tell you, I ran against a Green Party candidate one time. He's been on the show before, David Schwartzman. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Schwartzman started out, he was my opponent. He started out the first 45 seconds of his speech was how wonderful I was. You know, mm-hmm. this is a great guy. I love him. He's doing a wonderful job. You know, and I was so embarrassed by it that when I started, I said, David, I will not sink to your level. We're not going to allow this. You know, I said, if you try to hug me at the end of this thing, there's going to be all sorts of trouble. You know, because, and that's the kind of office I have. I just have to be honest about it. It's not like.
Well, that's not true. You have opponents.
I do. And some of them have said nasty things about me. I've had my daughter call me crying on the phone because she was sitting in a room full of, the older, both of them were hip hop dancers. And she read in the paper where one of my opponents called me a racist. And she called me crying on the phone saying, "Daddy, I'm sitting in a room full of black people. I'm the only white person in the room, and they're calling you a racist. They're calling our family racist." And we're, you know, and I'll tell you what, that stuff bothers, like you, Maria, who was bothered by it. It bothers the people around you more. You know, my wife, like you, is a basketball fan. And I often say to her when she gets upset, I say, "It's not fair to throw an elbow. It's illegal to throw an elbow. But if you can't take an elbow in the NBA, you need to be playing, you're doing something else for a living, right?" It's the same in politics. If you can't take the blows, and that's the hardest thing about it. So when I took my daughter, for example, my older daughter, and tried to, because I think she has all these great leadership qualities, and I tried to expose her to this, that, you know, that's what I said to her. I would not wish this life on you. You know, if it's something you're inspired to do, that's one thing. But if you're not inspired to do it, you know, you shouldn't do it because it's not easy.
Well, may I say that I have found that now in my PhD process, that lofty goals are often derided because of certain agendas. And I've never been knocked down more in my entire life than in the past 6 months. And people are like, "Well, why do you think only 2% of the population has a doctoral degree? Because they don't just hand them out." You have to withstand the struggle and the fight. And I was thinking, you know, academia is, it's about research and empirical results and testing and stuff. And at the end of the day, no, it's also about opinions.
Well, you know, absolutely. And, you know, and you're an amazing person, Maria. I don't think that the average person, I mean, you're up to the task. There's no doubt.
I have to tell you, I've never had a crisis of confidence like I have had with this in my entire life. I've never doubted myself more. I've never woken up in the middle of the night more and wondered, what am I doing wrong? Why isn't this working? How come it's not happening? And it's because of this arduous labyrinth of this thing called PhD that apparently is inherent in the process, much like what you are going through with your political career. Who knew?
Well, you know what? I used to have a political science professor when I was in graduate school. And let me say that my sister was so brilliant because I was on a PhD program. And I burned out for many of the things you're talking about. And I said, "I'm going to take a break." And she said to me, "How far are you away from a master's degree?" And I said, 6 credits. And I had taken all PhD courses. I wasn't that much further away from a PhD, but I had to do a dissertation and stuff. And she said to me, "Well, you know what? You should get your master's degree, which doesn't stand in the way of your PhD. And then if you want to go back and do the PhD program, great. But if you don't, you don't walk away with nothing." And so I did that, and I got the master's degree, and I never wanted to go back.
But you were smarter because you took her advice. Yeah. And you do the capstone or the thesis, but the dissertation is what distinguishes the one degree from the other. Right. And again, I didn't realize, well, as you saw, February 6th was the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation at the United Nations, and I flew in Wednesday evening and left Friday morning so I could be at the United Nations to attend the events, because that is something that matters to me. It's my passion, and it's also the topic of my dissertation. So I've got lots of skin in the game. And it still isn't getting me. It's not fait accompli. It isn't a rubber stamp. You don't go through these paces and get it at the end of the day. No, there's a committee and they challenge you. And it's ridiculously arduous.
And I think there are powerful political forces that are against what you're doing. I think, you
there
know,
are.
How many women in the world suffer this? Many women in the world.
200 million.
200 million. So there's obviously great forces at work perpetuating this. And
correct.
I'm sure they don't want any academic research or anything else. So you're a trooper, and we've run out of time. Can you imagine this? We've run out of time already. So maybe we'll have to have another show on the caucuses, as we're going to have several shows, I think, as time moves on.
Well, as this season unfolds.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So tonight, because I'm a little bit of a nerd myself, and Maria knows this, a great lover, I think we share this passion for Broadway musicals.
Yes.
Tonight we're going to hear, from my opinion, the greatest politician in American history, a guy named Harold Hill, who sold boys bands in Iowa. Here's something from The Music Man, written by Meredith Wilson and sung by Mr. Preston, Robert Preston, who starred in the Broadway musical. Here's the song Trouble. And I hope that's not true for Iowa, because I think it's a great process. And in the end, it may not be perfect, but it really, I really hope that it continues. And we'll talk to you next week. And Maria, please give the last word.
And it was the first feature film I ever saw in my entire life, Music okay. Man. Yes, my parents took me to it when I was little. I was four, I think. But I, as always, want to thank on both of our behalves our listeners who help make this program possible, because you pay attention, you download, you listen live, you share us, and we appreciate that, because it wouldn't be possible without your ears.
Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help me cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen...
representation in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.